Cases That Change People's Lives, the podcast series. You are very welcome to episode 2 of Cases That Change People's Lives. This episode reviewed the McGee case, 1973, in which Mary McGee, 27-year-old mother of four, took a case against the Attorney General and the Revenue Commissioners in Ireland because at that time she could not get access to contraceptives. This case was selected by then leading Irish lawyer and academic Gerard Hogan, senior counsel, who provided the commentary and analysis. It must be pointed out that after the making of this documentary in 2005, Gerard Hogan's career advanced significantly in the legal world. He was later appointed to the High Court, then to the Court of Appeal, and then he became Ireland's appointee as Advocate General to the European Court of Justice. Just recently, in 2021, he was appointed to Ireland's Supreme Court. I hope you enjoy the commentary and the analysis of this case, which quite clearly had far-reaching implications for women at that time and since.
My own personal opinion is that it's the most important decision the Supreme Court has ever given in its history.
Hello and welcome to the programme. That was Gerard Hogan, senior counsel and lecturer in the law school in Trinity College in Dublin, talking about the McGee case, which came before the Supreme Court in 1973. That case concerned the right to privacy and brought to a head the whole issue of the ban on the importation and sale of contraceptives in this jurisdiction. When we look back now, it's difficult to imagine how controversial this issue was at that time. But to give you a flavour of those times, here is an archive recording of a group of women who went to Belfast by train in 1971, and we hear them when they're returning into the station, making no secret of the contraceptives that they brought back to the customs authorities in Connolly Station in Dublin.
Well, I bought a packet of Durex and I bought the contraception pill, which I have here, and nobody asked me for them, but I said I had them, just sort of let me through. They weren't interested.
Had you expected this sort of reaction?
Not really, no. I thought that, you know, seeing it's supposed to be against the law, that they would sort of take them from me. I think now it's obvious, you know, with regard to contraception, that, I mean, it must be sort of okay now, mustn't it?
I've got that as well, and I'm not giving it to you. It's jelly. You're not getting it.
You mean putting up your bag?
No, you're not getting it. I refuse to give it to you.
Enforce the Constitution! Enforce the Constitution! Enforce the Constitution! Enforce the Constitution!
Well, those protesters were prophetic, because in 1973 the Supreme Court held that the law banning the importation or the sale of contraceptives was unconstitutional. When I spoke to Gerard Hogan, he began by explaining why he thought this case was so important.
I like to compare it in a way with the decision of the US Supreme Court. There's a decision of the US Supreme Court dealing with contraception, which we'll speak about perhaps later in the programme. But the one that I think is, in terms of its social impact, is the closest, is the desegregation case, Brown and Board of Education, in the US Supreme Court in 1954, which forced overnight a cultural change and a profound social change, the implications of which are still being worked out in the US. And the comparator, I think, for Ireland, for good or for ill, and I believe for good, and I think most people now would undoubtedly think for good, but for good or for ill, the comparator here is McGee, because with the decision of the Supreme Court in December 1973, which held that a ban on the importation of contraceptives, which was contained in the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1935, was unconstitutional. At one stroke, that heralded a really profound social change in Ireland. It led to the end, I suppose, of the confessional or quasi-confessional state that we had. It led to a sort of a sexual revolution which has taken place over the last 30 years. It had a profound change so far as the status of women in Irish society was concerned. It led, in a very real sense, it was a major step in the emancipation of women. It was a profound blow for personal liberty and for personal choice. It did all of those things and more. And of course, it heralded what I suppose was a sort of a cultural war, which probably has come to an end, but there's still some remnants of it being played out, kind of this cultural war between conservatives and liberals, which was played out particularly in the referenda on abortion and divorce in the 1980s and 1990s.
It'd be really interesting if you could just paint the picture in 1935 as to how this was drafted.
There was no ban on contraceptives prior to 1935. It only came about as a result of a majority report of a review group which was set up to review the law in this area, which reported to the Department of Justice in 1931. The government was slow enough to take on such a delicate topic, particularly given that it had implications, I suppose, for church-state relations, and particularly so far as the minority churches were concerned. It was finally, almost as an embarrassment, put into the Criminal Law Amendment Act of 1935. And that was an act which dealt with things such as prostitution and keeping a brothel and so on. And stuck into the back of this act with this prohibition on the importation of contraceptives. But up to that point, I won't say that contraceptives were freely available, but there's certainly no prohibition on them. And I dare say that if you knew where to get them, you could have got them certainly in urban areas prior to the 1935 Act. But the section was passed almost without debate in the Oireachtas, because as John Kelly famously said in 1985 during the Health Family Planning Bill, which was another one of the post-McGee debates, he said that the reason he said it was passed without the debate was that the members of the Oireachtas were too embarrassed and ashamed to mention the individual articles during the course of a Doyle debate, and that's how it passed almost without debate. One other, I think, important historical detail is this. I know that the conventional wisdom out there is that the Catholic Church had a very important role to play in the drafting of the Constitution. Now, I think my own personal opinion is that while it's true the Church had an important role and to some extent an influential role, it's vastly overstated. We now know that when the Constitution was being drafted, that Archbishop McQuaid lobbied heavily for not simply a ban on divorce, but also a ban on contraception to be written into the Constitution. Now, that was rejected. I suppose the Oireachtas and Mr. De Valera was embarrassed enough to go along with a ban on contraception at legislative level, but he was certainly unwilling to do it at constitutional level. And so the Church, which, as I say, lobbied to have a ban on contraception written into the Constitution, they were rebuffed, and there was, in the end, no such ban.
Just reading through the judgment, and at one stage there is reference to the fact that contraception, along with all sorts of other things, was not desirable within the state. But was it actually against the law? Was contraception against the law, or was it that this case hung on the importation of the contraception?
In the High Court, before the then President of the High Court, Mr. Justice O'Keefe, he found against Mrs. McGee on a number of grounds. One was, he said, that he noted that the measure had been passed more or less contemporaneously with the Constitution, and that was a good example that the drafters didn't think it was unconstitutional. Well, of course, if that was the test, many laws, or certainly a good number of the laws that were passed in the 1930s, have since been found to be unconstitutional. And of course, the courts have rejected the idea of a purely historical interpretation of the Constitution, or to say that just because something was passed in 1935, so contemporaneously to the enactment of the Constitution, that it couldn't be unconstitutional. They've since rejected that. But that was one ground. And another ground was that it didn't actually ban the use of contraceptives. It only banned their importation. But as the majority judges in the Supreme Court pointed out, in particular Judge Henshey, that was really a distinction without a difference, because it was a distinction based on form rather than substance, because the effect of it was that contraception was unlawful within the state. There wasn't any manufacturers of contraceptive jellies or condoms or prophylactic pills or anything of the kind in the 1930s in this state. So you had to import them. So the ban was aimed at the prohibition on importation. So it was, so far as the residents of this state was concerned, it was effectively a ban on the use of contraception.
One of the things, when you put it into a social context of the correspondence at the time in the papers, for example, and the kind of frenzy that it stirred up, that there was so much emotion about the issue. I mean, when you look back on the decision now, how difficult was it for the Supreme Court to come out with that decision? Was it at loggerheads with public opinion, or do you think it was a reflection?
My recollection is that there was correspondence about the McGee case as throughout the entirety of the 1970s. There scarcely seemed to be a day when there wasn't some form of other supporter or opponent of the decision writing a letter to the newspapers. And it's really in an era where contraception is actively promoted by state agencies, which is the situation now, or you go into public conveniences and you see advertisements about the desirability of using contraception and so on, and the advertisements that are aimed at young people in particular, it's a world away from what existed in 1973. And in fact, it's difficult, I think, for anybody who didn't live through that period to realise what a contentious issue it was. It remained a hugely contentious issue. Of course, there was agitation before the Supreme Court decision, the contraceptive train to Belfast and so on. But it remained a hugely contentious issue really up to the passage of the final liberalising measure, which was the Health Family Planning Act of 1985. That was Barry Desmond was the Minister for Health and gave rise to the famous Stand by the Republic speech by Des O'Malley. That was really the last major controversy concerning contraception. And that's why, in terms of the social context, it must have been an exceptionally difficult decision for the Supreme Court to take. And it was an act of great judicial courage and bravery and activism on their part to take that decision. And it must have come as a real shock to an awful lot of people that a court was willing to take such a momentous decision in this way.
In this groundbreaking case, it was turned down in the High Court. Mm-hmm. So most people would say, well, how on earth did it then come about that it was reversed in the Supreme Court?
The difference, I suppose, is that for a start, the Supreme Court, the majority of the Supreme Court, looked to the reality as opposed to the form. And the reality was that it was de facto a complete ban on the use of contraception. But I would also, I think, credit the composition of the court with a major role here, because there was, at the time, two really great and hugely influential judges on the Supreme Court. One was the late Mr. Justice Brian Walsh, who I think is widely credited with being the greatest constitutional judge we've ever had, and another really great judge who hasn't received the same degree of public acclaim, and I'm glad to say he's still alive, very much alive, Mr. Justice Henshey. Two exceptional judges of outstanding quality, and it was in a sense a tribute to those two judges, along with two other excellent judges, Mr. Justice Griffin and Mr. Justice Budd, who I think made the difference and had, as it were, the judicial imagination to see the importance of this case. What they said was this, is firstly, we have to give the Constitution a contemporary interpretation. It's not frozen in the permafrost of 1937. You have to interpret what these constitutional guarantees mean now and what we understand them to mean. The second thing is that they looked at the provisions of the Constitution dealing with, firstly, the in Judge Walsh's case, the right to family life. And he reasoned that if you protect the right to family life, you've got to protect the privacy of the family, the autonomy of the family, and the right to make decisions about how they, how a married couple will organise their own lives. And of course, once you reach that, once you're at that premise, it's very easy to say, and certainly with hindsight, it's very easy to see how a ban on contraception is totally at variance with the idea of a guarantee of the of family privacy and family autonomy. Judge Henshey arrives at his judgment in a slightly different way. He asked himself, there's a specific provision of the Constitution, Article 40, which guarantees the personal rights of citizens. And there was a decision in the early 1960s, the Ryan case, where the Supreme Court and Judge Kenny in the High Court had said that the personal rights referred to there were not simply the ones that were set out elsewhere in the Constitution, but included unenumerated or latent rights which the judges could determine. And drawing in part on that, drawing in part on a decision of the US Supreme Court in the same area, and in part on what he regarded as the protection, the actual specific constitutional guarantees, Judge Henshey said among the rights that are protected here is the right to privacy. And he found, having set up this test and having described the facts of the case, and let's not forget the facts of the case, here was a young married woman with children already. She had a medical condition which made having further children dangerous, and she was then confronted, as Judge Henshey put it, with the choice between effectively a form of platonic marriage on the one hand, or exposing herself to the risk of pregnancy, which could well be fatal or at least paralysing. And against that background, he said, does this legislation infringe the guarantee constitutional right to privacy? And there's a great passage from his judgment, which I think is worth quoting.
Right, OK, we might just have a listen to that now.
It is the informed and conscientious wish of the plaintiff and her husband to maintain full marital relations without incurring the risk of a pregnancy that may very well result in her death or in a crippling paralysis. Section 17 of the Act of 1935 frustrates that wish. It goes further. It brings the implementation of the wish within the range of the criminal law. Its effect, therefore, is to condemn the plaintiff and her husband to a way of life which at best will be fraught with worry, tension and uncertainty that cannot but adversely affect their lives, and at worst will result in an unwanted pregnancy causing death or serious illness with the obvious tragic consequences to the lives of her husband and young children. And this in the context of a constitution which in its preamble proclaims as one of its aims the dignity and freedom of the individual, which in subsection 2 of section 3 of article 40 casts on the state a duty to protect as best it may from unjust attack, and in the case of injustice done, to vindicate the life and person of every citizen, which in article 41, after recognising the family as the natural primary and fundamental unit group of society and as a moral institution, possessing inalienable and imprescriptible rights antecedent and superior to all positive law, guarantees to protect it in its constitution and authority as the necessary basis of social order and as indispensable to the welfare of the nation and the state, and which also in Article 41 pledges the state to guard with special care the institution of marriage on which the family is founded and to protect it against attack. Section 17, in my judgment, so far from respecting the plaintiff's personal rights, violates them. If she observes this prohibition, which in practice she can scarcely avoid doing, and which in law she is bound under penalty of fine and imprisonment to do, she will endanger the security and happiness of her marriage. She will imperil her health to the point of hazarding her life, and she will subject her family to the risk of distress and disruption. These are intrusions which she is entitled to say are incompatible with the safety of her life, the preservation of her health, her responsibility to her conscience, and the security and well-being of her marriage and family. If she fails to obey the prohibition in Section 17, the law, by prosecuting her, will reach into the privacy of her marital life in seeking to prove her guilt.
When you hear those words, how does that contrast to Judge O'Keefe's view?
It's a question of, I suppose, judicial priorities, judicial vision, and the sense of what the judicial role is. But what really comes across in this judgment from Judge Henshey is how the Constitution secures individual rights and individual liberties, and how it is ultimately for the courts to determine what the boundaries of these rights are, and in specifically where it concerns intimate personal relationships and personal autonomy, that is a key right which the Constitution must protect and which the courts must uphold. Of course, in hindsight, you can ask yourself, how could he have decided otherwise? But it is really, again, a remarkable passage from an outstanding judge, which really sums up the essence of what the McGee case was about. There is, Pauline, another passage which perhaps we might quote. It's a very eloquent passage from Judge Walsh. A great passage of judicial prose which really sums up what the Constitution, which the guarantee of fundamental rights is all about. And okay, I think it's worth listening to.
We might listen to that now then.
Articles 40, 41, 42 and 44 of the Constitution all fall within that section of the Constitution which is titled Fundamental Rights. Articles 41, 42 and 43 emphatically reject the theory that there are no rights without laws, no rights contrary to the law, and no rights anterior to the law. They indicate that justice is placed above the law and acknowledge that natural rights or human rights are not created by law, but that the Constitution confirms their existence and gives them protection. The individual has natural and human rights over which the state has no authority, and the family, as the natural primary and fundamental unit group of society, has rights as such which the state cannot control.
Very interesting comments there about that concept of control. And I think I've heard you say on another occasion that one of the significant steps which the Supreme Court took here was to portray the Constitution as a living document.
Yes.
Which, of course, in a way involves them in interpretation
of
society's views. And we get into that whole area of the court being in tandem with public opinion at the time, as you referred to earlier.
Well, you see, this is one of the great difficulties, and it's a problem which, if like activist courts, both here and in the United States and, say, in the European Court of Human Rights in Strasbourg, have all confronted from time to time, which is, by definition, a constitution or a convention guaranteeing fundamental rights is always drafted in an open-ended fashion. Words can mean different things to different people and can be applied in perhaps unanticipated ways to novel facts, and that's what happened, I suppose, in the McGee case, or certainly for a lot of people it came as a shock, that a profound shock that there could be a decision of this kind. But I think it's also worth noting that the Supreme Court really didn't finish the revolution which they started, because if you roll on the clock another 10 years to the Norris case, you find a sharply divided Supreme Court, with on this occasion the late Chief Justice O'Higgins delivering a very conservative interpretation of the constitutional guarantees, which is predicated on what the drafters would have understood in 1937, which, as the minority point out, was fundamentally inconsistent with the premise of McGee, which was that of a living document. And again, you have a really outstanding judgment in dissent from Judge Henshey again and from Judge McCarthy, where they find for David Norris. And I would go so far as to say that the dissenting judgment of Mr. Justice Henshey in Norris is the single best judgment ever delivered in an Irish court. And so that's praise indeed. But he even surpasses his eloquence in McGee with what he has to say in Norris. And it's a profound exposition of and development of what he said to McGee about the protection of the right to privacy. On the other side of the coin, however, you have to look at it this way. I mean, why did the majority in Norris uphold laws against male homosexuality, only for those laws later to be condemned by the European Court of Human Rights in 1988? And, of course, in technical terms, it's impossible to align the decision in Norris with the decision in McGee. But I think, as my colleague Professor David Gwynne Morgan in UCC put it pithily, the real answer is this, is that in McGee, the majority of the Supreme Court judged that Irish society was more or less or could be brought around to the decision in respect of contraception. But in 1983, a majority judged that Irish society was not yet ready for liberalisation of laws on homosexuality.
And in many ways, what you're saying there is interesting, because that relates back to the composition of the court, the Supreme Court, being a group of people at any particular time, taking upon themselves the responsibility of being the litmus test of public opinion, or what the general appetite, as you say there, that they're ready for it. I mean, it's almost suggesting that the court takes upon itself that mantle to decide when the populace is ready for a particular set of freedoms.
Well, I think these were special cases, and I don't think you should regard that as being a general rule, because most of the time the court is hidebound by technical doctrine and orthodox legal principles. But in cases of really high moment, and McGee and Norris and many of these other, the abortion cases of the 80s and 90s, were these type of cases. Ultimately, it's a question of judicial judgment.
Just in relation to that point you were making earlier about Judge Kenny saying that there were other rights that weren't necessarily clearly written, how in tandem with opinion worldwide was Ireland at that time of the McGee case?
This has been a huge debate within the United States as well. They have a similar type of unenumerated personal rights doctrine, but it's a very controversial one, and people who have been nominated by presidents of the US Supreme Court have been rejected by the Senate because of their views foreign against this particular doctrine. But in 1965, in a case called Griswold, the US Supreme Court held there was a right to privacy and invalidated a statute in Connecticut that banned the use of contraceptives. There was a difference, however. In Connecticut, it was a law that had more or less fallen into disuse, whereas in McGee, and this which made the Supreme Court's decision here much more significant, the law was very much in use and was still a live law, whereas the one in Connecticut had been more or less almost a national joke in the United States. But of course, significance of Griswold, which was relied on by the Irish Supreme Court in its decision in 1973, that paved the way for other decisions in the field of morals, sexuality, and personal autonomy. And we saw a case Roe and Wade in the United States dealing with abortion, and we saw 2003, after a glitch in 1986, the US Supreme Court reversed its 1986 decision, said yes, the right to privacy does embrace male homosexual conduct. But one of the reasons why McGee was so controversial was that it relied on the Griswold case, and many people, with, I think, some justification, feared that unless there was specific action taken now, that the reliance on Griswold would pave the way for the introduction of abortion or a limited abortion through judicial decision here. And that, of course, gave rise to the celebrated debates in 1981, 82, 83 regarding the pro-life amendment and the subsequent debates on abortion.
Having said that you consider this to be the most significant decision of the state, what one thing would you say it did that was so significant?
Two things. It heralded a new interpretation of the Constitution as a living document, and it brought about a social revolution in Ireland, the effect of which is still being played out.
Gerard Hogan, Senior Counsel from the Law School and Trinity College, thank you very much.
Thank you.